The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 401, premium for Thursday, June
7th, 2012. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab premium show. And presumably those of you that are listening to Premium know what we're all about here, but just in case, we're the show where you send in your questions, we try to answer those questions, you send in your tips, we share your tips, we share some of our own, sometimes we talk about stuff that's happening, but the goal here is to learn at least a few things new each time we all get together. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Brock.
Hi, John F. Braun. How are you doing today?
Fantastic.
Lantastic. Every time you say fantastic, I think of Lantastic. Did you ever use Lantastic back in the day?
Oh, gosh. I think I did.
We talked about this before.
Link two computers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I used it too much.
Yeah.
Over modem, typically, right?
Oh, I always used it with cables.
Oh. Yeah, it must have been something else I was using to let you do remote. Over the modem.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. So should we dive right into Jeff here and see if we can get back into the swing of things after we had our little departure on our 400th show there?
Why not?
All right. Well, the one reason why not is if you don't actually have the question in front of you, which I didn't at the time. All right. Jeff writes, in the past, you've mentioned smart mailboxes and mail.app. But I don't think you've ever touched on the difference between these smart mailboxes versus regular mailboxes. What's the difference and are they worth using? Well, of course they're worth using because they're smarter. No, smart mailboxes are based on rules and are merely, I like to think of them as lenses into your mail archive. There's no content that actually lives in a smart mailbox in that content is also somewhere else. The smart mailbox is just a filter that allows you to see mail that fits a certain set of criteria from elsewhere in mail. So that can be really handy. There's a lot of reasons you might use them. Smart mailbox that I use is I link with address book. It actually gets kind of funny, a little convoluted. When I travel, sometimes, especially if I'm on vacation or a semi-vacation, as I like to call it, my mail might mound up in my inbox and I don't want to have to go through the inbox and see, but there are certain people that I know if I get an email from, you know, one of these people, I want to see it. So I create in address book, I create a group called Priority Senders and I put all these people into it. And then I create a smart mailbox that the rules are, in fact, I can pull it up because I have it right here. And the rule is if the message is in inbox and the sender is a member of group Priority Senders, boom, put them in here. And so it'll fill that mailbox only with people that have sent me mail that's in my inbox. So I haven't filed it yet. And they're part of a certain group. So it allows me to filter it down. Really handy stuff. And you can get really creative with these things. And so that's the benefit of smart mailboxes. The mail still lives wherever it lives in your archive, but you can use these rules to help see your mail in a different way. Do you use smart mailboxes, John?
You know, I did I was experimenting with them for a couple of upcoming shows.
Okay.
And looking at it, it doesn't look like they're quite as flexible as the rule base that you can apply for a regular mailbox.
Correct. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that's what we talked about a little before, but I guess the thing that disappoints me is that the logic is very, well, it's either or. You can either say, show me things that match any of these rules or conditions, as they call them, or all of them. And I think I actually dug back and I think our own John Martellaro actually did a little write-up on everything you ever want to know about mail rules. And I think that's one of the limitations that really kind of bothers me, because in this case, having a rule where I could say this or this and this, you know what I'm talking about, would have been much more useful. But I use this to say, okay, so if it's from this email address, which is the email address for this particular show, and the date is after this, then put it in this, as you said, smart mailbox lens. And then what I would do is highlight them and then say move and move them into another mailbox. But it gave me a quick view. And yeah, as you said, it's just a view. It's not a physical mailbox. And once you get rid of it, then it goes away, but you're not actually deleting anything. Whereas, you know, with a regular mailbox, of course, if you get rid of it, then you also potentially erase all the messages in it. So,
right. Yeah. And, you know, not dissimilar to the smart playlist feature in iTunes or smart albums in iPhoto. I mean, it's that same concept. Of course, iTunes does let you do some grouping, which is really handy, but you know, that's iTunes. So, and by that, I mean, you can create, I should watch before I leap here. But in iTunes, when you go, you know, file, create smart play or new smart playlist, or if you're editing a smart playlist, you've got, just like you do in Mail, the little plus sign along the side that lets you add criteria, and you can say match all or any. But then you can also hit the option key when you hit the plus sign, and in iTunes, and this does not exist in Mail, but in iTunes, that lets you create subgroups, which can get really, really handy. And you can create subgroups within subgroups. So, and you can say, you know, with the subgroups, you get to pick that either all of the conditions or any of the conditions are true. So you can really get complex with it. And it's actually really handy at times. So have you played with that, John?
Not yet.
All right. Well, I'm sure you will. All right. Moving on to... Shall we move on to Gary, or is there anything more you want to
add?
Okay.
Yeah, I think Gary has a tale of woe.
He does, but hopefully we have a, we'll pass it back and forth, but you start with him.
So Gary writes, I was checking my mail when a violent sneeze, sounds like Jeff Gammon, caused me to lose my grip on my coffee cup and coffee spilled on my MacBook Pro. Oh, no. I'm under Apple Care, but I'm aware that it does not cover accidents, which, yes. As far as I know, that is true. Now he mentions he's due some money in refunds from an internship program. I was wondering if it's best to use that money, which I guess it's several thousand dollars, to have it repaired or to buy a new MacBook. The computer in question is a late 2009 13-inch that was bought in March of 2010, just before Apple did a refresh. And then he has another question, which we already answered. But and my response was, so we both responded. So here, I'll give my take on this. Oops. Oh, gosh. I don't see my reply in here. I think I just... Oh, no, I'm sorry. All right. Hi, Gary. All may not be lost. And then I relate to him a thing where I had actually had a liquid spill incident. And I guess I'll mention what I did. So I had a liquid spill incident. What I did immediately was to take the machine, turn it upside down. You know, so I grabbed a towel, turn it upside down in hopes of... the liquid going in the opposite direction. And I think I accomplished
away from
this.
The motherboard.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So I turn it upside down, put it on top of a towel, let it sit there for a while. And then I replaced the keyboard. So what happened is that I did not nuke the machine because I think the architecture or the way this machine was built is actually the keyboard. Pretty much the whole thing had what I guess is some sort of, it almost seemed like electrical tape was surrounding it. So I think it prevented the liquid from going inside the machine. And I don't know if that's the case for all of the Apple keyboards. What happened, though, because it was a beverage that had a lot of sugar in it, is that it eventually gummed up some of the work. So some of the keys didn't work. So in the meantime, I got by with an external keyboard. But then I ordered, I think it was iFixit. I ordered a keyboard, replaced it myself, and then everything was working great. And then what happened is a little while later, another issue, which I do not believe was related. I think it was a GPU issue came up. And... sent it to, called Apple Care, said, you know, I'm getting this error in the console and stuff. And they're like, yeah, I think we're going to fix it. And it turns out, I think they replaced either the GPU or the motherboard. So my question to him is the machine totally dead or does it still function? In my case, it still functioned partially. And then the other advice I have is, you know, you can just be brutally honest and tell them, you know, hey, you know, look, had an accident and, you know, check the machine out and maybe they'll let you get away with a flat rate repair. I don't know, but it can't hurt to ask. I mean, the worst that can happen is they'll say no.
Right. That's true.
I found, you know, being honest with them, and I know people, you know, that listen to us that are techs say, you know what, the worst thing you can do is when you come in is to lie and say, oh, I don't know what happened. Don't do that, because you're going to get on the wrong side of the technician or the geniuses. You know, to be honest, and maybe they'll show pity, or if the damage isn't as bad. Now he, and maybe you want to pick it up here, but he actually did reply to my query here.
All right. Well,
or I'll continue.
No, I can share the experience that I have and the advice, which builds on what you just said, which is be honest. We've heard several stories from people that have had water damage. In fact, I think our own Brian Chaffin was one of these people that told me this. And as the stories go, you walk in, you say, hey, I'm under AppleCare or, you know, warranty, whatever it is, or not. You know, and I have a problem with my machine. It got wet. Now, in many cases, Apple's policies on whether or not they can cover things that got wet are pretty straight and narrow. The trick is if the liquid sensor, and they've got these little liquid sensors, the iPhone has a couple of them and your MacBook has them too. And it's little white pieces of something that turn pink when exposed to water. And they take a look, and if it's pink, then that qualifies you as having had liquid damage. And so certain parts, in fact, most parts of your warranty no longer apply. But a lot of people have gone in and said, hey, look, you know, I spilled something on this. What can you do? And the techs at the Genius Bar are really smart. They know, OK, let's look. Again, you've been honest with them. You're treating them kindly and you're looking for begging for mercy. And in many cases, you can have liquid damage without the liquid sensor ever having been tripped. And if that's the case, then they'll cover it, at least in pretty much every story that we've heard about this. So, you know, so it's, you know, what you said is absolutely the right thing, John. Go in, be honest, and just ask, you know, what are my options? And they might tell you, hey, you know what? You're in luck. And they're going to be able to fix it for you. It's worth a shot. There's very little harm other than spending a little bit of time. So.
Yeah, and I did find an article. Well, we'll link to it, but actually Apple does have an article at least showing you in the iDevices where the liquid sensors are. I think a lot of them, if you look in the headphone port, you can headphone jack. I think sometimes you can see it.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. Yeah. The dock connector supposedly has one too, I think. Right.
On the new, oh, good. Well, if you click on that link that I just put in our chat room, I guess my experience is that, you know, if it's anything that has sugar in it, you know, like soda, or if you put cream or something in your coffee, or like in my case, it was a beer, anything that has sugar in it, you're probably going to screw things up and then it's going to come up the works. So if it's just pure water, you may have less of a chance. And I think to pass something along, we have had a few people in our circle have a liquid damage with iDevices, and actually what has worked. So a little tip here with an iDevice, like an iPhone or an iPod, as soon as you can, well, number one, of course, remove it, you know, whether it fell in a toilet or a sink or something.
Sure.
Putting it in a bag of rice seems to, because I guess rice absorbs the moisture. So for a lot of people, that has helped and recovered the device. If you didn't get too much water inside of it, I've heard that that's a good thing to try.
Yeah. And there are actually, people that sell bags. I think it's, is it the thirsty bag or something that iFixit sells that does exactly that, right? It is a bag of something better than rice, apparently. So worth, we'll put a link to that in the show notes too. Worth having around. I think you can get them for pretty cheap. So I'm trying to find it, and now I'm not able to, but we'll put it in the show notes, but it's worth having one around. So, anything else to do on this one, John, here?
Nope.
All right. See, now I'm building your show notes for you on the fly. And so that takes time. Moving on to Harry. Harry asks, in at least two episodes recently, Dave has spoken about issues with the Drobo FS, and that if he had to make the choice for network network attached storage. Again, he might have chosen differently. Being in a situation where I need to find a NAS device to replace an antique Snap server with a whopping 100 gigabytes of storage and find some type of large storage device for my wife's massive iPhoto library, about 500 gigabytes and rapidly climbing, I am interested in the possibility of these needs being met by the same device. Two questions. Is it even a good idea to store iPhoto libraries on a NAS device? And if you were to do it all over again and choose a device other than a Drobo, what device would it be and why? So I did. I've ranted about the Drobo FS, and I've actually gone pretty deep on this and figured out what it is that I am having a problem with, and have reported it to Drobo. And they've actually confirmed that they found this and are investigating a fix. There is no fix promised, so I want to make sure that's clear. But I think they're certainly curious and interested in solving it if it's possible. My issue with Drobo is their networking and file sharing software. Okay. When I first started with Drobo, I had a Drobo second generation, which is the one that you connect to your Mac or some other device via either USB or FireWire. And that worked fine, and it still works fine for me. I also, with that, got a Drobo Share, which was horrible. The Drobo Share was this device that it was built to sit underneath the Drobo, and it connected to the Drobo via USB and then to the network via gigabit Ethernet. And it's, the idea was that this thing had a little essentially embedded Linux server in it, and it would share your files, but it was really slow. And even worse than it being slow transfer rate wise, it was really slow to navigate directories and that sort of thing. Well, I'm seeing the same problem with the Drobo FS. Although it's not slow transfer rate wise, it's really, really slow navigating files. And I believe the problem is that the core of this software that's in it, when I have, I have my iTunes library. I tried to keep it on a Drobo FS, and I have, I don't know how many songs I have, many tens of thousands of songs. There's about 2,500 artists. Okay. So if I open my music folder, it's going to list about 2,500 artists. If I open that folder up on the Drobo FS, it takes about 3.5 minutes before I get a directory listing. That's really slow. If I open that same folder on a SATA drive internal on my iMac, and I have this same folder in multiple places for testing purposes, and yes, it was a pain in the neck to get it everywhere, but now I have lots of backup, so bonus. It opens in like half a second. I also put that folder on the second generation Drobo hanging off of my time capsule, essentially acting as an air disk. And on that, opening that with ostensibly slower drives, because I kind of put my leftover drives in the Drobo second generation, on that, it opens in like a second. It's really, really fast. And the reason is the Drobo isn't, the second generation Drobo is not managing its own file system. It's just acting as a drive. And so it's the time capsule that's doing the work of managing the file system, and it does it more intelligently than the Drobo FS or the Drobo Share does. So I think this problem, the good news is that this problem, I think, is solvable with software. Here's the thing. When your Mac is managing a disk that it's directly connected to, it can cache things in the file system. It can be really intelligent about it, and it doesn't have to constantly read from the disk. On a network device, though, you do not want your Mac caching anything because, let's say John and I are on the same network and both connected to the same network device. Well, if John goes and makes a change to something on this device, I don't want to trust my Mac's cache of what was on there because it's now wrong. So because of that, the Mac does not keep any caches or minimal caches of what exists in the directories on a network device. So it has to constantly ask, hey, what do you have? And it seems like the Drobo, at least the FS or anything where they run their own networking, is not intelligent enough about this. So I do think it's solvable via software. Now, I don't know if there's limitations in the hardware that keep the software from expanding to the point where it would actually be manageable. But that's hopefully what Drobo is working on, because it really is. I really like the Drobo. and the concept of it is great. You know, if I go get another NAS device and I do a RAID thing, I have to get all the same size disks, which isn't a big deal on day one. But let's say, you know, you're 2 years down the road and you have a disk go bad. Well, now, you know, you've got to find a drive that's the same size. And if it's not the same size, you know, you've got to go through this whole rigmarole of formatting it the right way and then upgrading potentially everything. So it's really handy to be able to just put any size drive you want into this Trobo and it mixes matches. And so today, if I had to give you buying advice today, I would say do not buy the FS. Buy a Trobo, you know, second generation, or Trobo S rather, I guess is what it really is. And just share it yourself from something. And that can be okay. If you need maximum transfer speed, then I would go for a more traditional RAID unit. But even on the Trobo FS with fast drives in there, you know, I get 700-800 megabytes a second. So it's not that bad. Megabits a second. Sorry. Not megabytes. I don't want to misspeak on that. So the answer to the question, the second question regarding an iPhoto library is we keep Lisa's, you know, which is our family's iPhoto library. That's only about 200 gigs, but we keep it on that Trobo second gen and it's zippy. She doesn't notice any problems with it at all. So that's connected via USB, even not even FireWire, but USB to the, you know, to the time capsule. And then she connects wirelessly to it and she says it's fine. So there you go. Any thoughts on this, John? I know you have an FS.
My only observation is the only thing that frustrates me about the FS is that when I wake my MacBook Pro from sleep, it does not immediately appear in the sidebar. To your point that I think there's something with whatever AFP stack or whatever they're using in there, because I guess it's basically a little baby Linux machine.
Yeah, my guess is they're running NetAtalk or something like it, which is the open source AppleTalk thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and what happens is a lot of times, you know, because I schedule my time machine, a lot of times when I wake my machine, it's all ready to do a time machine backup because it realizes it hasn't done one in a certain amount of time. And typically it'll come up and fail because it doesn't. I think it tries for 1 or 2 minutes to locate the network volume that you identified. And if it doesn't find it, then it says, oh, can't find your network volume. Sorry, I'm going to give up. The next time around, it's fine. But that's the only complaint that I have right now. And I should actually probably document this and get in touch with them. Because I'm wondering if there's something they could just optimize. Because my other devices, like, you know, my Mac Mini, which I also, you know, share on my network. I mean, that shows immediately in the sidebar as a shared volume. So.
Yeah, there's just something. I don't know what it is. And I feel like it's an easy solution, you know, and I laugh when I say that because back, you know, when I was doing the consulting, I used to love it. I'd pick up the phone. I'd say, hi, this is Dave. Somebody'd say, you know, I got something. It's going to be really easy for you. It's like, oh, really? Is that, you sure about that? You know, is that why you're calling me? Cause it's going to be easy. Let's go with that. You know, so maybe it's not easy for the Trobo people, but it seems to me like it could be. And maybe that's wishful thinking because I'd love this thing to work better. So, all right. Was there anything else we had in there? One of the things that I had researched for Harry was, you know, the OWC's Mercury Elite Pro RAIDs, because those things are screaming fast for what they are. You know, I mean, they're regular drives in there, but, and you can get even faster if you do SSDs, but that gets way pricey. But, you know.
As does. Well, the other thing, so you know, we saw at Macworld, and I saw some of the up-and-coming Thunderbolt implementations.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I saw some of these, especially when they, I forget the level of RAID they were doing, but I think they daisy-chained 4 of them together. And I saw speeds. It was like 800 megabytes a second. It was insane. Hundreds of megabytes a second. I don't think they, at that point, or even now, I'll have to check the pricing on that. So you'll pay for it, but...
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Yeah, I think, I mean, depending, OWC says you get, you know, 250 megabytes a second over eSATA, but depends on what kind of drives you put in there. But it's fast. But again, more to me, if you're moving huge HD videos around, then that speed totally matters. But... You know, if you're just streaming them, then the speed doesn't matter because you don't need all of it that quickly. But really it's the latency thing. So, all right, what do we have here? Oh, we have, we had a lot of comments on show 399, which was the last premium show that we did. And so we'll start with a couple of them as questions. And then I think we're going to kind of migrate into tips, but, Jared, this was actually an interesting thing. Jared wrote, and he said, in episode 399, you guys had quite a discussion about the archive button and its function in Apple Mail, and also how it relates to Gmail. As you know, it works flawlessly in iOS, but in my opinion, it's super lame on the Mac. And he says, when I created this folder, and I go into Gmail to look at it, it doesn't just say archive, it says IMAP in brackets, and then a slash, and then archive. And I'd love it if this IMAP in brackets went away and there was some way for Mail app to work with the archive function just like it does on my iOS devices. Well, here's the interesting thing. And at first I thought that that this could be avoided, but the IMAP thing cannot be avoided. There are certain mailboxes, certain label names that you cannot use inside of Gmail. And believe it or not, archive is one of them. And I don't know why they do this, but things are reserved. They have voicemail is reserved. Archive is reserved. Obviously sent and drafts and trash and all of those are reserved because they're already in use. But archive is reserved and it's not in use. But what happens is if you go and create an archive folder from your mail client over IMAP, it doesn't know that this is reserved. So what Gmail does is it's really smart about it. It says, okay, you want to create something called archive, I'm going to go ahead and prepend IMAP to that so that you can still create this archive box and yet it's not going to confuse anything that Gmail needs to do. So that's why you see that. And yes, it is frustrating because archive is the name of the mailbox that you want to create in order for this archive function to work. But you have to do it that way. And you know, you create it, you call it archive, but it's going to say IMAP/archive. And that's just Gmail's way of dealing with the fact that you're creating a mailbox that's using a name that it would otherwise not allow you to use. So there you go. That's the answer, Jared. I wish I had a workaround, but the workaround is don't use Gmail. But there's so many benefits to using Gmail other than Google having all your life and their servers, but otherwise it's good stuff. So, and for free, you can't beat it.
And I just figured something out.
Yeah, go.
So I was looking at the screenshot that he sent us. I was like, wait, my mail doesn't look like this. And what he did is sent us a screenshot that shows him highlighting a mailbox. And then there is an archive button in the toolbar.
That's right.
I'm like, I don't have that in my toolbar.
Of course you don't.
I don't. Well, why not?
Because you upgraded from a previous version of OS X and you don't, it just wasn't in your toolbar, but you could put it there.
And that's what I figured out. So just a handy little side tip here. If you, I do a 2-finger tap here, but if you do a control click in the toolbar, in Mail app, and then select customize toolbar, ... Lo and behold, you will get, oh my goodness, look at all these things.
You can also you can get to customize toolbar from the view menu as well, but either one, it does the same thing. Yeah. Right? John, did I lose you? I think we lost John. John, are you back?
Yep.
Awesome. So you had beach ball spinning, if I understand this correctly.
Yeah. Same thing we seem to have before. I think it was Skype. Got a beach ball on Skype, tried to type something, nothing happened, and then it came back.
Very interesting. Well, we're glad. Yeah. We're glad it's all back. All right. So you were saying about the archive button and your mail toolbar and your customization thereof.
Oh, and pretty much wrapping that up is I was able to find, you know, the part of mail. And I said I hadn't yet tried the archive feature, but I might as well at some point.
Yeah, it's handy. If you are going with the concept of throwing all your mail into one mailbox and then using search, or as we talked about at the beginning of the show, smart mailboxes to find your mail, because really that's what a smart mailbox is just a persistent search, right? Then the archive button could be your friend. All right. You ready to take on Michael?
I don't know if I'm going to take him on.
All right. Well, Michael had a follow-up question to $3.99, I think.
Okay. So Michael says, I remember you saying that it was best to upgrade to Lion, erasing the hard drive and starting fresh rather than upgrading from Snow Leopard. Yes, I think that is our recommendation. Yes. And I remember you saying that it was not a straightforward process. And no, it is not. But you would post the directions. As much as I look, I can't find it on the website. And actually, I couldn't either. So I thought I posted an article about this. But can you point me in the right direction? And I was going to write and tell him. Well, I did. So I found an article. I think the best summary of the options that are available here is a wonderful little article by Dan Frakes over at Macworld. And it says how to make a bootable Lion install disk or drive. Awesome. I actually hadn't explored the drive part. Though certainly I think anything that you can make a DVD, a bootable DVD out of, you could certainly make a bootable drive out of it.
Yeah.
They're pretty much the same thing, right? Yeah. It's just different media. I never thought of that. To me, it would seem kind of wasteful to, though maybe you want to make a bootable Lion install partition, in which case I'd see that. Otherwise, I'd see a hard drive as being kind of a wasteful use of hard drive space, because the installer is what, 4 or 5 gigs, I think.
It's the unfortunate part is it is just larger than how much space you would have on a 4 gigabyte thumb drive. So you need to go to an 8 gigabyte thumb drive or some larger drive. But you know, as you were saying that, I was thinking I have some old like 5, 10, and 20 gigabyte portable hard drives, and that would be perfect to put this on if the drives still work.
You know. All right. And to summarize, so he goes into more detail with the options here, but at a very high level, this is what you want to do. So what you're going to see is if you download the Lion installer, you should see something called install Mac OS X Lion.app in your applications folder. What you then do is a handy trick that we just love. And that is you right click or control click on that file, and then you will get a contextual menu item called show package contents, because it's really, I guess, a folder or a package, which is a special type of thing that doesn't appear as a folder, but I guess underneath it all it is. And then within that, you will see a contents folder, then a shared support folder. And within that, you will see a file called install esd.dmg.
That's right.
And that is DMG disk image of the Lion installer. And then he goes on to say there are a number of options here, but I think they all involve you bringing that over into disk utility, I guess is the best utility. You could use another one. Bring it into disk utility. What I've done is bring it into disk utility and then I guess say burn disk image and put in a DVD and wait a while. And there you go. You have a bootable Lion installer. And I guess the other option is you could do a restore operation to a hard drive. And then that will make a Lion installer on a small hard drive. Or I guess, as you said, Dave, a thumb drive is certainly another option.
Yeah, just make sure you get an 8 gigabyte one. The 4 gig ones, just not quite. I mean, you're talking a couple of 100 megabytes shy of big enough to hold that, which is just too bad. But
well, I guess because a DVD is what, 4.7 gigs, which I think is just correct. Enough to hold this.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I had gone through this when Lion first came out, and I grabbed that install.esd file, and before I installed Lion and then had it wipe it away, I took a copy of that and put it out in a folder on my Drobo FS, right? So sitting on the network, in a folder on a share. Then several months later, Apple updated Lion, to 10.7.1 or whatever it was. And that required a new download from the App Store. And when that update happened, it went and found on my Drobo, it found that install.esd image and updated it, which I thought was really bizarre that it actually went out on the network and found this. I mean, I get that they're, you know, being thorough and trying to keep everything up to date, but that's just creepy. So thought I'd throw that out there. All right. Going into the tips section, Andrew writes, in 399, you spoke about mail rules. Here's a little secret for server-side iCloud mail rules. This could help out the guy that was going over his 99 rule maximum. You don't have to have the full email address to create a rule. For example, rather than having a rule for John at MacGeekGab.com and Dave at MacGeekGab.com going into the same folder, you can just set up a rule for at MacGeekGab.com to have that go into a folder. So mail from any address ending in at MacGeekGab.com goes to the folder you specify. I use this for all mail I get from the New York Times, The Economist, Macworld, etc. I subscribe to lots of different services with different email account names, but common domains. I had the same problem that your questioner had with the 99 rule limit, and this is the way I was able to ditch some rules to make room for others. That's excellent. That's the whole, you know, bumming code, bumming lines. I like that. That's good. Thank you, Andrew. Good tip. Brian.
And I think the same applies to Gmail. I think when I built a rule there is you can do a star dot whatever and include a whole domain rather than individual addresses, if it makes sense to do so.
Yeah, there's a web page that one of us will find and put in the show notes at Gmail that describes the flexibility that you have when creating rules there. It's a page on Google's help in their knowledge base, because it is, like you said, John, it's far more flexible than it might appear when you first look at it.
And if I recall what they support, because I do have one rule, and what I do to separate them is use a vertical bar, which means or. But I think they also support an and operator, which I believe they use an ampersand. So I'd like theirs, because as opposed to mail, where I was griping about that earlier, it would appear that the Gmail filters are much more sophisticated as far as the logic behind them, which makes me happy as being a logical type of guy.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's nice to be able to program things and have them do what you intend for them to do. Speaking of which, we did a little bit of programming and setup this morning, and I think it's still working. We, as promised in show 400, we wanted to create a more regular streaming option for those of you that care to listen while we record the show live. And so we did. We set up what's called an Icecast server. Icecast just being the little engine that does this little magic. And it's running out on one of our servers on the server farm. And then I'm using a piece of software here called Nicecast, which is from the Rogue Amoeba folks that also make Audio Hijack Pro, which we use for the show, and Piezo, which John uses to record the backup copy and all of that. And so I'm just taking the audio live that we're recording and also beaming that from my Mac using Nicecast up to this server. And then that's going to all of you. And the webpage is MacGeekGab.com/stream. And it's very bare bones at the moment. Really, I threw it up this morning very, very quickly to get this test up. We've had, a handful, maybe a couple, a double handful, triple handful of people listening in. Today, I just posted it just before we did the show. Really, I wanted to kind of load test this thing, so I didn't want to have hundreds of people. But we have a good number up there now, and actually the server is pretty much asleep. It doesn't even seem to care. So we certainly can have lots more of you out there listening, and would love to. So we need to tweak out that webpage. If anybody visits that page and has any great ideas for what to do, that would be great. We also are still using the chat room that was provided by Justin.tv. We will probably host our own chat room or do something different with that, so we're not forced to keep using their chat engine. But for today, obviously, it made sense because I really wanted to focus on getting the stream out there. We still need to get the stream to be multi-browser compliant, because Firefox doesn't like to stream MP3 stuff, because Firefox only does truly open source, and they're really crazy. So, but Safari works, and we have lots of Safari and iOS users listening, and you can stream to your iTunes, of course, from it. So anyway, that was a little bit of programming that we whipped together for you this morning, and it seems to be working well. So hopefully we will have a more consistent streaming option for audio as we do the show, because it seems like there's a sizable contingent of you that that enjoy that, and so that's what we're here for. Your delight is our intent, right? Isn't that right, John?
Really?
Why not?
Okay.
Delight. Yeah, sure. We have a note from Brian. Brian is the creator, content manager of KeynoteUser.com. And we mentioned KeynoteUser.com when we were talking about this when we were talking about Keynote files being single file packages or single files as opposed to packages now, back in show 399. And Brian had this to share. He says, you guys nailed it. You're right. Keynote files are by default zipped packages. That's not obvious. But if you add .zip to the end of the name of a Keynote file, you can double click and unzip it. If you leave it like this, filename.key.zip, it should keep its .key tag and not turn into a dead folder. If you remove .key and change it to .zip, it will break it when you unzip it and simply turn it into a dead folder. It's a handy little feature if you need to hack open a Keynote file that's been zipped like this, or at least convert it into a working package. And it's not just Keynote files. Pages files do this, and I believe Numbers files do this. And again, it's built for portability. It's so that you can take this Numbers file and copy it to a FAT32 volume or, you know, anything, and it's still readable. So that's why they're doing this, and they're unzipping it on the fly. So thank you very much for following up there, Brian. We really appreciate it. That's always handy to know a little bit more about what's going on, because that's what we like here. And John, I think you've got something to add to this. Yeah.
Yes.
Awesome.
Because I was scratching my head. How could one figure out that this is a zip file, Dave? So I did a little digging. So one, I went into the terminal, and a lot of times what you see in the Finder is not what you see if you try to do a directory from the terminal. So I created a little, with the latest version of Keynote, created a little Keynote presentation, went to where I stored it, or changed to that directory, did a ls, and it came up as Keynote presentation.key. Like, oh, okay. Because I thought it'd come up as a .zip file. All right?
Yeah.
But then here's the cool part. So how could you tell if this was in fact a zip file, Dave? And I'm going to tell you. So this is where I started racking my brain trying to remember the command within the terminal or Unix that will do this for you. And the command is file.
Oh, really?
And what file does is file tries to identify. And this is what I believe is used at the lowest levels of the operating system when it's trying to figure out the nature of a file that you're trying to interact with. And so what's cool about this, so what I did is I typed file, space, and then the name of my Keynote file, and it came back and said Keynote presentation.key : zip archive data, at least version 2.0 to extract. So the file command knows that it's really a zip file.
Dude, that's awesome.
That just thrilled me to death.
So wait, tell me this again. Was the command just file, space, and then the file name? Wow.
Correct. Yeah, if you type file in the terminal and then a space and the name of any file, it will give you a little more information about that file.
Really? That's pretty awesome, man.
Yeah, we'll try. I'm going to try another one here. I'm going to try it with a PDF, and let's see what... Yep, and it says PDF document version 1.3. So, and if you do a man on file, it'll give you all sorts of things. But if you just type file space and then the name of the file, it'll give you a very high level. I think it'd probably do a lot more work. And it mentions says there's a number of ways it can do this. And one is, and this is where I thought the command was called magic. And I think in some versions of Unix it is that there's something known as a magic number. A lot of files have a predictable structure. And that they usually have certain characters at the beginning, like I think just off the top of my head, like a BMP graphic file, I think has BM or MB, BM at the beginning.
And this is
one way, and there's a whole big database of this stuff, and this is something else I'll link to as well, because I think there's a whole big project, and Unix certainly draws on this. Because otherwise, I mean, it could be really difficult other than a file extension. So I guess the message here is that a file extension is not the only way that an OS can identify a type of file. And that it's possible, I think, if you remove the extension, that it may still be able to figure out, as long as again, it has a something that's in this magic number database.
Yeah, interesting. So if you, a little side tip, one thing that's always a pain is, you know, this command is file space and then the name of the file. But unless you're really comfortable with the terminal, it can be a real bear to either type the full path to the file or navigate there via, you know, CD commands and that sort of thing to get to the directory where you can just type the file name. So there is an easier option. Open up a terminal, type the word file that you're going to have to do manually. So F-I-L-E space. And then, and maybe you don't need the space. I'm going to try it without the space, but, and then in the finder, find whatever file it is that you want to get information on and just grab it and drag it like you're copying it, but you're not. Like you're copying it, drag it to that that terminal window. You do need to put a space after the word file, because otherwise it's not going to work. But right wherever your cursor is, it's going to paste in the full path to that file, whatever it is. It could be three lines long, and it's going to go ahead and put that in there, and then you just hit return. So you type file space, you drag it in like you're copying it, and you'll see the name and the whole path and all the mess appear, and then you hit enter, and or return, rather. There's my Unix mind thinking. You press return, and boom, there it goes. So that's my side tip for you, John.
Yeah, well, I got a side tip.
Yeah, go.
To me, that's too complicated, man. So you just type file, space, type in the first few characters of the file, and then hit tab, and that should do an autocomplete.
But that's only if you're in the directory that contains the file.
Yes.
Right. Whereas if you drag it in, it's going to give you the directory.
Sure.
Yeah. So yes. But if you're in there, that's right. Tab is awesome for file name or directory name completion.
Because I've noticed what it does is it'll fill in the special characters. Because, yeah, a lot of times the command line has a problem dealing with special characters and spaces and stuff like that. For example, one of them I did here, it had spaces in it. And so we would do the first few characters, then a backslash, then a space, then...
Yep.
So it would encode it properly, so when you hit return, it wouldn't say, huh?
Yep.
Which could happen if you just type out the name of the file straight off.
Yeah, right. Yeah, oh, yeah, that can be a real bear. Very cool. Anything else on this one, John, or are we ready to move on?
I think we're ready to move.
Are you sure? Mm-hmm. All right. That means we're moving on to Paul. And I will find Paul here. I was actually... distracted checking the bandwidth graphs for the live stream here, but it seems pretty much inconsequential as well. So that's a good thing. This is excellent. I'm glad to see this working as well as it is. It's nice when something comes together like this. All right. That's MacGeekab.com/stream is how you would get there. And now with Paul. This is really interesting. We're going to need more information on what we're about to talk about here. So Paul writes, I have 8 gigs. And this was, again, in response to something we were talking about in 399 with SSDs and machines using up RAM and that sort of thing. He says, I have 8 gigs of RAM in my 13-inch mid-2010 MacBook Pro running 1074, so Lion. And I was in exactly the same situation as Scott's, where my machine was using up all my free RAM, just like we described. Paul says, until I installed an SSD. I've been running my system for over a week now and have not once dropped below 2 gigs of free RAM. However, prior to installing the SSD and running off of it, I was regularly dropping to 10 megabytes for no apparent reason. I just thought I would share this with you guys in case it helps other listeners. So we don't have a whole lot of data on this other than what Paul has seen and some of what I've seen that's sort of separate. But anyway, it seems like there's something going on. Lion certainly is aware of what type of media you have for each drive. And in this case, specifically for your boot drive. Lion knows that you have an SSD, and then it also checks to see if the SSD supports that trim command, and it will use the SSD differently if it does versus if it doesn't. And so what Paul is suggesting here, and it certainly makes sense, is that Lion is saying, hey, if we've got all this stuff on an SSD, we don't necessarily need to be so aggressive about storing it in RAM. In fact, we can free up RAM because we know we can get it off the SSD very, very quickly. And I've never heard anything of this, but it certainly makes sense that it could be done, and it makes sense that Apple would do it. I don't know if we'll get any answers about that at WWDC next week, but it's certainly a question I intend to ask. And if I get an answer I can share, I will. But I'd be curious as to anyone else that running Lion that has seen anything like this, because it seems interesting, certainly plausible, but we haven't heard anything specific from Apple saying, yeah, this is what we're doing and this is why. Interesting stuff, though, John. In theory, seems like a good idea.
That's a good one. I'm just trying to think about it based on what I know about OS design, if it would make sense for you to look at things like the rotational speed or the type of media. I mean, yeah, as you point out, certainly if you go to System Profiler, it'll say, oh, it's a
solid state versus
rotational or solid state.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it does anything different other than trim. I mean, the trim obviously is something you can't do or it makes no sense to do it on.
Well, and it also probably
rotational drive.
It probably doesn't. I hope it doesn't try to do any of that hot file management and the defragmentation that happen on rotational drives automatically. I mean, that's
good
that's
point
my
because
hope.
I don't. Because it doesn't make any sense. I mean, the thing that I have seen is utilities. I believe. Like I think I tried this once just for kicks, is I think I tried to do a defrag with Drive Genius.
Yeah.
On an SSD just to see what would happen. And I think it came up and said, you know, this is a SSD, you know, doing this is kind of stupid. You want to do it anyways? I'll do it. But
sure. Yeah.
You're not going to buy yourself anything by doing a defrag on an SSD.
Right. Right.
As far as I know.
Yeah.
Except, you know, burn up your write cycles.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. It's bad for it. In fact. Yeah. Really bad. All right. Let's see. Lastly, in terms of HP printer software, Gary writes in with a tech tip. He says, although most HP software packages and OS X have uninstallers, they often do not necessarily uninstall everything throughout the system. However, there is a scrubber option in the HP uninstaller that will do this. Start the HP uninstaller, choose which printer software you want to uninstall, and then, as you click the uninstall button, hold the command, option, and control keys down, and that will get you a full uninstall that'll wipe out everything. So thanks for that tip. I had no idea that existed. It's crazy I don't understand why the uninstall wouldn't do all of that, but at least now we know how to make it do all of that. Because a lot of times you want to uninstall and reinstall as troubleshooting or problem solving. And if you're not removing everything, then you have less of a chance of solving any given problem. So, thoughts on that, John?
Who thought of that? Oh my gosh, what a crazy key combination.
Well, it's all right there at the bottom of the keyboard. It's like, you know, handy. Easy access. Yeah.
Well, you won't hit it by accident.
Well, you could, if you're like leaning your whole body down on the keyboard. That would be a bad idea. Maybe your whole fist. Pounding the keyboard. I want it all uninstalled. And then magically it works as you pound your fist on the control option and command keys, right? You want to tell them about the first thing that Felix sent in for Cool Stuff Found here, John?
No.
All right. You want me to tell him?
Yes.
About it?
Okay, yes, I do. Did I say this? I guess I did. But Felix says, I remember John was saying how he missed the color icons in Lion. I do as well. And he said that Mac OS X Daily sent this and it puts the color back. And we'll link to this. It's a piece of software called Side Effects.
Yeah.
And I wonder if Secrets does this too. Let me look in my Secrets database.
Okay.
While you do something else there.
Yeah, no. So this does add, you can see a screenshot if you go to the Side Effects website, and it adds all that luscious color back to the Lion sidebar. So that's right. It's good stuff. Does Secrets have anything, John?
Oh, they got quite a few tweaks here. I'll let you know in a moment.
Okay. All right. Well, Felix sent in two, thank goodness. And the second one is something called Cheat Sheet. Now, Cheat Sheet is a great way to see most of, I don't think it shows everything, but it shows most of the keyboard shortcuts. And all you do is you hold the command key down once you have Cheat Sheet installed, and you can get it in the Mac App Store and it's free. You hold down the command key for 2 seconds and you'll get a little overlay that pops up that shows you all of the available keyboard shortcuts and what they correspond to. So for those of you that like keyboard shortcuts like John and I do, this is likely going to be one of those super duper cool things found. And thank you, Felix, for hipping us to that, because that's what, to me, that's what Cool Stuff Found is all about. Do you have anything?
I got another one. Yes, I do.
All right.
Just to shock you here, but
yeah, shocking.
Oh, I did a write-up on this long ago, and every now and then I'll use it. I don't think I've, KeyQ, KeyCue at Ergonis.
Yeah, but is that still being made? I thought Cheat Sheet was kind of like taking over for Ergonis's lack of attention to the market.
Version 6.1 was released on April 10th, 2012. So
I'll give you that's still being made. Yep.
Yeah, and it's a 1999 euros. So they're across the pond somewhere. Okay, yeah, it's the same people that they do a bunch of other things. Pop Char. Okay.
Yep.
But that's one that's been around forever. I think that's a good one. So that's another utility that, yeah, I think it, depending on the app that you're in, you hold down certain keys and it'll show you all the keyboard shortcuts. So.
Awesome. KeyQ. Cool. All right. And then one last Cool Stuff Found before we wrap things up here is from Paul. And Paul writes, I saw this and thought it was so cool. I just had to share it. And it's called Leap. And it's a tiny little USB dongle for your Mac that then lets you, he says it actually lets you remote control your Mac with your finger, as long as you have this little dongle thing in front of it. So really, really cool. Leapmotion.com. I don't believe it's out yet, but definitely pretty cool. I think you can pre-order it at leapmotion.com. So it's $70 and we'll put a Cult of Mac article up that, well, let me see if the video is here at Leapmotion or if we need to send you to Cult of Mac. Nope. You can see the Leap introduction video right there at Leapmotion. So check this out. Yeah. $70 pre-order and just go watch the video. It's a minute long. So you'll make it. I'm gonna even put this in our chat room here because we can do that. And oh, Coder Kev beat me to it. Thank you very much, Coder Kev. So yeah, check it out. Leap Motion. Did you watch that video, John?
No.
All right. Well, I guess. I think it's time, John, to see if maybe we can convince the band to come back in. We can. You got anything else to add here, John, before we go through our contact information and all of that good stuff? John?
No. No. The only thing I could add is if you want to contact us, Dave.
Yes?
You should probably, if you're listening to this, well, some of you may not, but some may, but you probably want to send an email to premium@macgeekab.com.
That's for all the premium subscribers. premium@macgeekab.com.
Or premium@macgeekab.com.
That's right. And if you happen to be listening on the stream, perhaps, if you are a non-premium user and you want to email us, that's feedback@macgeekab.com.
Feedback@macgeekab.com? Is that what you said?
I did. Is that right? feedback@macgeekab.com. Did I get that wrong?
No, that's correct.
Okay, cool. You can also call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
And you can Skype us to MacGeekab, of course.
Facebook.com/MacGeekab.
That's right. And you can find us on Twitter, MacGeekab, to follow. That'll let you know when the stream is coming up. You can follow him at John F. Braun. You can follow me at Dave Hamilton. You can follow Pilot Pete wherever he is off to, and at Pilot Pete. And then Mac Observer for all your headlines, all twitter.com/. And then keep an eye on MacGeekab.com/stream for our live stream as that gets better and better. And really, I meant what I said. If you visit there and you've got some ideas about doing a more universally compatible HTML5 player in the browser and that sort of thing, please email us at any of the above. Contact us somehow. Let us know what you're thinking, because we would love to help make that work better for you. That's the idea. And I guess that's that. We'd like to thank Michael Johnston. He did not convert show 400 because he was swamped and he didn't want you to wait. So show 400 was not sent out as AAC, but hopefully this one will be. And he, of course, does the We Have Communicators podcast. So go listen to that too, please. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth to get the podcast from us to you. Except for the stream, that's just coming straight from us to you. That's how we roll. And lastly, the next show, which will be show 402, will be our 7th anniversary show. We will be doing that on our 7th anniversary, which is next Wednesday, the 13th. I think we're going to record early in the morning, about 9 a.m. Eastern is the plan, which means it's 6 a.m. for me on the West Coast. Yeah. But we'll squeeze that in there, and that'll be after the keynote. I will be at the keynote at WWDC. You can follow along with that at liveblog.macobserver.com. So we'll see what happens there. I'll be doing the coverage on that. Have a great weekend, folks. We'll talk to you on the other side. Have fun. Don't get caught. Made up.